But it would be unfair to actually discuss counterculture without first defining what is culture. So the reason which brought me to actually do this class was I was reading one of LaRouche's paper from 2004. It's called Religion and National Security, the Threat of Terrorist Cults. It's around the question of the Martinist Freemason, but really it's not really the whole issue is really the mentality of people in the Martinist, but really broadly the disintegration of the culture overall in the last, let's say, 50 to 60 years in the United States and worldwide. And he was giving 4 points, really briefly, that I wanted to read with you, where he basically, that gave me this idea for the class. So I just want to read this, or somebody can read it, and we can discuss it a bit. But that's around that standpoint, or from that standpoint, that I wanted to orient the discussion around this class.
Who
was it? That's LaRouche. So, whoever wants to read it, Marwan?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, there are chiefly four axiomatic qualities of which distinguish matured normal men and women from sophists and empiricists in general, and the Martinists most emphatically. So this can be summarized as a series of four interdependent but respectively distinct these, as I do, as following. Now, first, a normal representative of the human species is distinguished from the beast by the capacity to distinguish objects of thought which correspond to the existence of experimentally valid universal physical principles which exist beyond the reach of sense perception as such, but whose existence is susceptible of conclusive experimental proof. The discovery and proof of these principles, first as hypotheses, and then as experimental proof of principle, is achieved through the human mind's unique capacity to recognize the footprint of anomalies in the ordering of perceived events. The term cognition is properly restricted but to references to the process of discovery and proof of principles which solve the relevant anomalous paradoxes. In mathematical physics of Gauss, Abel, Dirichlet, Wilhelm Weber, and Riemann, this defines the physical reality reflected as the complex domain.
If you have, yeah, I know that's a lot. Yeah. Even just to begin.
Okay. Wait. The mastery of that acquired view of the physical reality corresponding to the complex domain has been the keystone for the educational self-development of the youth movement which I have sponsored. Second, in many cases, man is able to apply these efficient, universal, but non-perceptible principles to the universe around us. That to the effect of increasing the relative potential population density of the human species, or on the particular culture which benefits from that practice. This distinguishes the human species categorically, ecologically, from all other living species. This is the basis for my original definition of corresponding principle of a science of physical economy, a practice of physical economy which I have defined as Riemannian in essential form. Third, the sustainable progress of society depends upon the transmission of these discovered principles, both horizontally and forward, through induced replication of the relevant cognitive experience of replicatable individual discovery by individuals. This process of combined transmission and creation of ongoing new such discoveries of both physical science and classical modes of artistic composition is a proper reference for the term culture. Fourth, the preceding three principles situate the mortal human individual in such a way that the mortal existence of each is implicitly immortal, not as merely a living creature, but rather also as a cognitive being whose existence is a contributing feature of the continuity of the culture and of the human species in general. The images of the greatest known scientific discoverers, classical artists, heroes, and statesmen of history exemplify the sense of cognitive immortality potentially available to each of us. They who realize this in their outlook and practice live in a simultaneity of eternity, within which they are immortal presences living with us today. The true interest of the human individual, the only real wellspring of true morality, is to dwell among those companions forever, even after we were formally deceased, to prize above all other things that principle of agape as uttered by Plato, Socrates, and the Apostle Paul's 1 Corinthians 13. The true nature of man and the principle of agape so defined are inseparable notions.
Okay. Any comments? That might be something that people are not, you know, it's not really something that we discuss every day on the bus. These are things that LaRouche points out and which are really concise. But really what he terms culture is not just the idea that you're going to pass to somebody else like something you figured out, but really that, you know, you're gonna have a society which is gonna be based on this idea that man can actually discover principles of the universe that will actually communicate that to new generations, actually make, you know, that as a basis, and that's actually the basis for the continuity of a society, a civilization. We know what?
Can we term culture as what is the culture to define meaningful human existence in the direction?
Well, I guess it's part of it, yeah, in a sense, like your culture. Well, that's going to be, yeah, if you take it from the standpoint of the last paragraph, I would say yes. Like that, it's something which is meaningful because it's principle. Also, like that's also where the meaning comes from. But from that standpoint, like that's what I think we should take first, actually look at what the counterculture is. And we're not going to listen to rock music or any of that stuff. But what I'm going to do is we're going to look actually at counterculture. I don't know. I told you different things. But we're not going to listen. But we're going to actually, to understand counterculture, it would be bad just to take it from the 60s on and look at it from that standpoint, but it would be, because that would be much more like kind of a symbolist kind of, or just a sense perceptual approach or, yeah, experience kind of thing. But what I wanted to see is, well, where is the counterculture coming from? you know, where are these ideas coming from? Actually, to understand that, you have to go back 2 centuries ago. Because there's no way you can actually figure out what the counterculture was all about if you don't go 2 centuries ago and look at this event. Does anybody know about that event? We're talking about this, the Vienna Congress, or Congress of Vienna. Huh?
Heard some things.
Okay. Well, the Congress of Vienna in 1815 had a huge repercussion on our baby boomer parents, because that's really where basically the oligarchical system of Europe decided to impose itself over the world and to restructure the Europe of 1815 as it was before the American Revolution, and we'll get to that. But really what happened is that you had Europe was pretty much a mess, because you had you know, the French Revolution and the Napoleonic period, where basically there was war for almost 20 years nonstop, and empires building and all that. And so an alliance was able to, of the British and others, had been able to defeat Napoleon. And now they were discussing in Vienna how they would actually structure society, how they would actually reestablish monarchy and serfdom as a their system, to control the population, make sure that, you know, their system would stay. So basically the principle of the Congress of Vienna was no change. It's going to be no change whatsoever. So it's going to be the same as it was before. And so they came together, but obviously all these guys didn't necessarily like each other. There were, you know, different empires and different kings and all that. But what they were agreeing on is that they had to destroy this concept of progress, that actually in a lifetime a man could become free, and free is you know, these fellow man of burdensome work by developing technology, by developing a new way of organizing society. And so basically they were using people like Madame de Staël, who is actually she's the niece of the minister, the French minister, well, actually was a Swiss banker who became the French minister under the French Revolution, and we know the rest. The king and the queen have lost their head for that. But you had Madame de Staël, and you had also Emmanuel Kant, which were big time promoted at coming out of the Congress of Vienna for their kind of, well, yeah, the romantic, which we'll get to in not so long, romanticism from Madame de Staël and her big intellectual salon that she had in Switzerland. And also you had this concept which was developed at the time of the Geisteswissenschaft versus the Naturwissenschaft, which was this idea that's clearly what Immanuel Kant was doing. They were saying, well, there's actually two worlds. There's one world for human beings, like to investigate their own feelings and emotions and whatnot, like history. That's kind of arbitrary at some point. You know, it's hard to understand, really. And on the other side, you have Naturwissenschaft, where that's like the pure science, like, you know, the facts. What you see, what you can measure, what you can quantify and all that. So basically, they created these two branches, which before didn't exist. It's just like you didn't have, you know, a department for sociology and history and all that, and you didn't have like the department for the nerds who are studying science, computer science nowadays. But that didn't exist. There was actually an idea of a unity that you could have a scientist who could be, you know, also an historian who could be, you could make discoveries in different fields. Take the example of the Renaissance period with people like Da Vinci. That was like something which was feasible. You could actually be a universal genius, or you could actually see that there was something which was common about science and art, which was that these two are developed by human beings, that actually the human mind can understand both. Actually, that's from there that it comes from. So, but these guys were like, if we let that happen, we're not going to be able to stay in power. Never going to, you know, they didn't like change. So they said, we're going to actually make sure that these guys, we can just put them into a department and they're going to do the work for us. That's it, that's all. And so, what they were really fearing, and, you know, I put the romantic here, but that would be wrong to actually see it like that. Like, you know, like, there was a classical or, like, that's for music, but that's usually how they, you know, they teach it in school nowadays. It's just like, oh, yeah, you know, you had that period, and then at 1750, then everybody changed. Everything changed. It's just now it's something else. It's classical or it's romantic or, you know, and it just changes just like that. Well, the problem is that, you know, that's not how history works. Mm-hmm. That's not how change are made in history. And so that's really what we can get from actually what happened in the Congress of Vienna, how they shaped the kind of the curriculum and how to study.
So that diagram of history has been influenced directly by...
Well, in a sense, what that the view of actually teaching people like that, like not necessarily going through the idea, the concept that actually brought upon the change. I'm just saying, like, okay, that was, you know, that's where it starts. It's not really how history is made. But what these guys were really fearing was the impact that the American Revolution had over the world. And that's really what they wanted to stop from happening in Europe. They wanted to preserve the oligarchical system for ruling society in order that there would be no change. Everything would stay just fine for them. And so somebody could, I'll just read it. Because these are the ideas, these are the principles which were validated in history of the American Revolution. This is from the Declaration of Independence. It says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So that doesn't sound good for an oligarch. Like, if you hear that, if you hear that some people are thinking like that, actually there's no difference between the king and, you know, the guy who's just piling up the garbage. That's scary. That's scary. So they were saying, well, you just can't let that happen. And so they launched this operation with the Congress of Vienna to destroy science and art. But also, think about it. I don't remember what was the population, but I mean, you have 13 colonies with these ideas here. That if we are able to defeat a world empire. Okay? Because, I mean, I don't have a map of it. Maybe I should have put it there. But the British Empire, after 1763, had won over the French Empire. And so the world was basically the British Empire's property. It was all... You still had, like, little French colonies remaining here and there, and Dutch colonies or German colonies. You had some. But really, worldwide, all the commerce was ruled by the British Empire and its company, the East India Company. And so, for 13 colonies to actually defeat the biggest army of the world at the time, hey, you gotta have a reason to fight. You gotta have something to also uplift you and keep on fighting until you win. So that's in 1776. The Congress is in 1815. And so they had seen what had happened in America, and they were, you know, at all costs, they were going to stop it from happening anywhere around the world. And so they crushed the French Revolution. They crushed any kind of uprising that could have led to another American Revolution. So, also, because as I was saying before, this concept of the Naturwissenschaft and the Geisteswissenschaft, like the human sciences and pure sciences, didn't exist before. And he had inspiration also coming from Europe. It's not like all of Europe was necessarily like oligarchs, or people were thinking like oligarchs. But he also had this German poet, Friedrich Schiller, who was discussing this question of what is a human being, and what kind of conception, what is a beautiful soul? Like, how do you actually bring a population, you actually uplift the population, and bring these principles of the American Revolution all around the world? That's really what he was discussing. And he was discussing it in his historical work, in his playwright, in his poetry, and he was also, he had to flee the oligarchy for that reason. But there's this poem, which we could write we could read afterwards. But I took this excerpt just because that's, a conception of the artist, which is not necessarily partaken right now. And so in the artist, and you can see here, just wanted to show that in the United States, Schiller was a great poet. He was a poet of liberty. And so, yeah, in New York, in Detroit, he had statues all over the place of these inspirators of the American Revolution, and also those who wanted to bring it in Europe at the time. He says of the artist, he says, "The dignity of man into your hands is given. Protector be. It sinks with you. With you, it is a rising." So clearly, there's a role for the artist, which is not just to be out of society, outside of it, and contemplating it, and just writing, little poems about that, but really to be involved in a process of bettering society overall. And that if actually society goes away or decides to crush art, well, actually, that's going to bring upon society, that's going to bring it to an end. That's going to destroy it. So Schiller was expressing that in his poem. And that's also coming from the study. I'll just maybe have a segue here, but yeah, it goes together. I mean, this idea was like that you were looking at society and also the accomplishment of the modern civilization, of the European civilization, and clearly to come back to what I had pointed out with the Congress of Vienna. Actually, there was like the Romantic era that was beginning with that event. I want to figure out if you could discover what is the difference. it's not necessarily that. Well, the difference between Romanticism and, you know, classical culture. So I took these three pictures and of different sculpture. One is romantic, the other one is classical, or more so. But there's an idea, because right now, if we look at the chart, you know, that I just showed before, this one, well, all of this, actually, and that's for music, but that's applied also in different contexts, like for different, you know, the dance, the different stuff, but now for music, they say this is all classical, or almost all classical. Oh no, okay. The same. There's different. The Baroque, the classical, the Romantic, and then 20th century. But really, like this idea of classical, is not really understood today, as it was understood by people like Schiller. And so they were looking at Greece, and they were looking at Rome, and they had certain ideas about them, and the ideas which were actually promoted in these different societies, which nowadays have not really passed to us. Like there's been a block somewhere which avoided that we actually see that as an evidence, actually. But okay, maybe not the sculpture. Maybe we'll try to see with some poetry. Try to distinguish what. Rob, can you read the poem?
She Walks in Beauty by Lord Byron. She walks in beauty, like the cloudless, like of the clouds. Cloudless climbs and starry skies, and all that's best of dark and meek in her aspect and her eye, thus mellowed to that tender. Are there words missing?
That's, I don't know. That's what I got from. I saw different. No, I think it's. That's what it is.
That's okay. That's mellowed to that tender, like gold, like that money. Which heaven to gaudy day denies. One shade the more, one ray the less, had half impaired the nameless grace, which waves in every raven tress, or softly lightens all her face, where thoughts serenely sweet express how pure, how dear their dwellings. On that cheek and o'er that brow, so soft, so calm, yet else, the smile that wins, the tint that glows, but tell of days of goodness spent, a mind at peace with all below, a heart whose love is innocent.
Isn't that nice? What do you think?
It's beautiful. I was going to cry.
Please go.
Yeah, it's pretty nice.
Cute.
Well, That's a romantic poem. Lord Byron was one of the well-known romantic poets. They were like, you see, he died a little bit after, like 9 years after the Congress of Vienna. But really, these guys were promoted all around Europe. That was the way that you were supposed to actually write poems. That was the romantic way. That was the trend. That's how you do it. So, but yet opposition to that also. That was to show a bit, you know, just have fun. I didn't take the most. Anyway, it's a good one. But yeah, Heinrich Heine was making fun of the Romantic school. He saw that it was just basically a perversion, that they were just using words for using words and not really like getting any kind of understanding. Or that they were just, you know, yeah, romanticizing, like really just making fools of themselves, in the sense that they were just contemplating stuff and not bringing up any kind of concepts or discoveries. So I think Lamar wants to read it.
I read ahead.
Yeah, I know.
The old dream comes again to me. The old dream comes again to me. With day, night, stars above, we two sat under the linden tree and swore eternal love. Again and again, we plied the troth. We chattered and laughed and kissed. To make me well remember my oath, you gave me a bite on the wrist. Oh, darling, with the eyes serene and with the teeth so white, the vows were proper to the scene. The perfluous was the bite.
So you see, nice description. Like, I mean, white teeth. You know, it's really, it's really nice. But you can see like what kind of irony he was trying to bring up to the, you know, the people, and shock them. It was just, you know, it's shocking. I had a more shocking one, but I decided. But really, that was, and he was just reacting. He was writing kind of in the same way as all these guys by making, you know, nice observations and love stories. Everything was so fine. And then, bite on the wrist. So that was not acceptable. Like,
that's over the top.
You didn't need to.
You just imagine.
Just the oath was fine. Just, yeah. I swear, but don't bite. So you can see what kind of, you know, he was just making fun, you know. But that was the good way to go about it, because these guys were so ridiculous. It was just, yeah, over the top. So. So that's for the romantic. I think we have a better idea now of the difference. Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that Heine is, you know, that was the classical poem form, but that was obviously an attack on romanticism. You know, trying to get these guys a bit more serious. So now we come to talking about the counterculture. So. That was around the 1830s. I'm going to go a bit over a few years, and then we'll be able to discuss. What? So. Yes, he is. 30-30. And I didn't do it because you were here, Ivan. I didn't do it because...
I think the subject, which we to me, a most important politically is mass psychology. The importance has been enormously increased by the growth of modern methods of propaganda. Of these, the most influential is what is called education. Religion plays a part, though a diminishing one. The press, the cinema, and the radio play an increasing part. Maybe hoped that in time, anybody will be able to persuade anybody of anything if he can catch the patient young and is provided by the state with money and equipment.
Thank you, Bertha.
Was that an opium?
It might have been. Wow. So, to understand counterculture, we got to understand the ideas behind it. And counterculture is not like, was not this kind of, you know, freedom of speech and freedom of whatever you want to do and this and that and liberty and that wasn't the idea of the counterculture. But we got to look at who actually defined it, and I think that's a good quote from Bertrand Russell. But we're going to look at him and also other friends of Bertrand Russell, which I don't know if we can imitate as well. But yeah, H.G. Wells was part of, and well, Bertrand Russell and H.G. Wells, they were part of the Fabian Society. That is basically an oligarchic organization out of London and different places in Europe, but mostly in London, who had an idea of actually controlling the world and of a world empire, by continuing the legacy of the British Empire and just developing it more and more into just crushing completely any kind of idea of freedom, of actually changing the meaning of freedom so that people would be less, you know, that they would actually be okay with slavery, but that they would call it freedom. And so, yeah, Bernard Shaw is also part of the Fabian Society. We talked about basically what is the Fabian Society all about. And the Fabian Society, that comes from the name, came from a Roman general, was actually known for a quote saying that basically it is not good to, well, the least attack as possible, like the least frontal attack, but you want to actually go around, you want to in a sense flank, but you want to actually make like the psychological warfare. That's what he was actually discussing, how you actually bring the opposition on your side, not by attacking them, but by influencing them. Maybe. So I don't know, maybe flanking is not the right word.
Bending their will.
Yeah, well, right. But you don't want to attack. You don't want to cause like these kind of casualties, I guess, in terms of warfare. You don't want to just create casualties for nothing, but you want to actually stay really powerful by just eliminating the opposition.
But there's an additional fact, because his full name was Fabius Cum Cator, and he was the general who successfully fought off Hannibal for a while. So it's even an additional factor is, how do you get a superior enemy to destroy himself? Because he understood that there was no way the Romans could directly wage war against the Carthaginians with Hannibal as their general. Because he would waste an army after army. He killed hundreds of thousands of Romans in direct battles. So he said, we're not going to directly engage him. We're going to subvert him. We're going to force, we're going to wage a war of attrition against these guys, and that's how we're going to defeat him.
Yeah.
And
that's true.
And it was highly successful. But so that's because remember the period, like what Jeff was going through last night.
Mm-hmm.
This society comes into being after the Civil War.
You don't go too
fast. Okay.
Anyway, that's good. Okay, so somebody has to read the quote. And that's not H.G. Wells. That's Bernard Shaw.
Where's your grace?
Matt?
Our propaganda is one of permeating. No, it is. Our propaganda is one of permeating. We urge our members to join the liberal and radical associations in their district, or if they preferred it, the conservative associations. We permeated the party organizations and pulled all the strings we could lay our hands on with the utmost adroitness and energy. And we succeeded so well that in 1888 we gained the solid advantage of a progressive majority full of ideas that would never have come into their heads had not the Fabians put them there.
It was
true.
It was said by Bernard Shaw.
Yeah. Part of the Fabian Society.
He's known as a playwright today, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And also a big promoter of Nietzsche. So there was obviously an intention. There was obviously something that was going on at the time. And as Rob has mentioned it, well, the intention was actually to destroy the idea of progress, which was actually spreading into Europe just after the Civil War had been won by Lincoln. And that now the American system was spreading. And that was causing great pain to the British Empire and to, you know, more like the world state that these guys wanted to create. There was a battle. Yeah, never mind. I'll come back to that. But just to keep in mind that there's also these guys, they're in the oligarchy and they don't like each other. They're just there to actually rule everybody else. So they might get along, like to get their empire, but then they just stab each other in the back. So H.G. Wells was in the Fabian Society for 5 years, actually. He got kicked out. He was too radical for them. They wanted to, as you can see, huh?
Or even them, you know, too
radical. Yeah, exactly. So from 1903 to 1908, he was in the Fabian Society. Then he kind of shifted, but still the same mindset, but different actions. So that's also like how we get to look at the different currents in counterculture as not necessarily being the same thing, but actually originating from the same intention. That's just one thing I wanted to add right now. But we're going to come back to
putting people in both sides.
Yeah, exactly. Like
liberal,
you know,
conservative, who cares?
Yeah, as long as you stay, you know, as your allegiance is to us. Right. So it doesn't matter, yeah, in which party. Just completely wanting to control everything. To have a world empire. That's part of it. Yeah. These are like all part of the same institution.
Gang
counter gang.
But we gotta go back and have some fun. With the first hippies. Okay, we're gonna talk about hippies.
I thought it was a cult.
Well, that's a hippie. Well, that's pretty much what the hippies were. Well, that's it. These are like the sons of oligarchs. Decided to have like some fun one summer, and they created kind of an institution that was in Switzerland, just close by Lake where it was said that it was beside the island of Capri, that area of the Ascona in the Monte Verita was also like a that was for the Nordic people. It was like their ancient mythological site, like where they had runes and different stuff like that. And different people from everywhere, like in Europe, were just congregating there, just, you know, every summer. And it began like to be a real institution, where you had like basically raves during the summer on that hill. And so you had different, I'm going to name a few people, but really, and the idea is just to know that these guys are from different origins, like from Europe. They're from different organization also, kind of the first hippies. Also anarchist, this guy here. This guy is Michael Bakunin. He's known as, you know.
He was there?
Oh, yeah. He was one of the first, actually. In 1869. And then you had, he's a well-known anarchist leader. He was like, you had Karl Marx on the communist side.
Anarchist leader?
Kind of. It was, okay, you got me there. Well, yeah, he was like the mentor.
That's a good one.
He was really the mentor. And you had, so on the communist side you had Marx, and he was like the antithesis of Marx. He was like, we gotta, you know, destroy. It's time to destroy modern civilization and just start it over. So he made friends at Monte Verita. And so you had anarchists, you had anthroposophs, which are we'll get to that. It's kind of the weird. It's all very mystical. Like this is a mythological in their sense, in their point of view. Like they're just congregating there to like have rituals and different stuff, and they're gonna create like hotels and. But really, like at first, it's like hippies. It's like anti-industry people, vegetarians. It's really like that's what they're there for. They want to create a new world order, and that's where they're going to start from. So you have this guy Hermann Hesse, who's also a writer, you know, famous Hesse, Hermann
Hesse.
So he's, you know, he got cured for cocaine there. They had like these therapies. They would have, they would actually cure themselves by having sun bath and air bath. That's what these guys are doing actually. They're the eurythmy, like that's being on the good tempo. Eurythmy reminds me of. But that's what they were doing there. They were just camping there, and so you had people like Ida Hoffmann. You had people like what we call the Vanderbogen. Doesn't ring a bell? Okay, the Wanderers. Yeah, right. Exactly. So, yeah, these kind of people were going around and, you know, trying to recreate the old order, like the so-called, you know, Nordic way of living. It also a lot of dance. I didn't mean to be... So, yeah, this guy, also von Laban. Huh? That's probably the sun dance. I don't know. That's von Laban with his three wives. And this guy was brought in, was invited there by Theodore Roers, who was one of the, kind of the leader, was a, you know, top mason. He had different title. And he invited him because they wanted to have dance and different stuff on the hill. So he was in charge of actually creating these the Sonnenfest. And you think about it, like, it's all people, like, from different milieu, but also, like, you know, sons of oligarchs and also chief of state and authors and poets. And they're all congregating there and having a big feast. And, you know, these guys are supposed to be in charge. Like, you know, they're just, like, with different types of... It's everybody congregating there. And what they do, which is really... weird, is that just right during the First World War, because remember that started like in 1869, they're continuing up until the 1920s, around there, kind of loses traces of what happened there after that. But now we're in 1970, and these guys are still having you know, feasts on the hill, and it's just, you know, during the First World War, there's a, how do you call that? Theodore Roers and Ed von Laban are inviting people for a, I think they call it the A-National Congress for Development of Self, something like that. So you had also Carl Jung was there to interpret the, you know, the subconsciousness of all these guys who were dancing around the fire and telling poems about the sun. So that was basically, like, that was the first kind of hippie movement in Europe. And you see the intention of Jung at the time. He's just saying, like, you know, during First World War, bombs are dropping on Germany and France, and they're there on the hill in Switzerland, and they're partying. And a guy says, well, the sole hope is that after this purge, which is the First World War, no, instead of our artificial civilization's idols, there would once again surface positive instincts. So his positive instincts were what he called the festive society, or the festive civilization. And so he said, well, we gotta bring, you know, the emotions out and just let people go wild.
Sure, sure.
Then, well, it's just like, it's kind of, you know, that's all part of that do whatever you want kind of ideology, which was brought in also in the picture by these guys. So you have a really highly mystical faction in there, which is, that's Theodore Roers in his Mason suit. And then you have Madame Blavatsky, who's like leading theosophist. They were meeting there. They were having chats over what was their policy. And that's the, I've never seen it before yesterday. I didn't know about that. But that's the Theosophist emblem. And so you can see here, the swastika is actually one of the emblem of the Theosophist. And, but it's not a coincidence. Theosophy comes from actually Buddhism. So it's actually people who... And this is where the faction, like the Oriental side of it, comes from. Like all the Asian type of reference, you know, Buddhism. And, but, I mean, this is like the evil side of it. I'm sure that you can't necessarily just put Buddhism in there and say, like, it's completely evil. Or, I mean, I wouldn't do that because I didn't do the work on that. But these guys clearly have an intention to insert the mysticism of Asia into the European culture. or actually they say like they want to actually destroy overall European civilization. They hate it. They hate civilization as it is, and they want to, as Jung said, after the purge, it's going to be our system. It's going to be, you know, the Aryan race is going to be clean. Everything's going to be clear. So we'll have our dominance over the world. Not one.
I'm kind of going ahead. I read the quote. It sounds very much like it seems like a direct input on the 60s and 70s culture.
Yeah, I hope my class will bring that idea in everybody's mind. But yeah, clearly, I mean, that's like in the beginning of the century. That's in, you know, these guys, the Sonnenfest 1917, but these guys were already going there for quite a long time. I think it's like, these guys are taking over, like the faction, the Theodore Royce faction, takes over around 1895. And so that's, you have a split, you know, again and again. They have a split, like, between the ones that really don't want to do agriculture. Well, they want to do agriculture, but not mechanized agriculture. They want to really keep it simple. And then you have the other faction who's like, well, we want to have an hotel and, you know, have cures for, you know, have sun baths and whatever to cure people and just get people here to, you know, bring about that change in the overall population. Maybe, again, a split.
Was Kellogg a part of the split?
Kellogg? I don't know.
It was like a Kellogg. You know,
I heard about the guy.
You know the serial Kellogg.
He started
out as being a health kick kind of guy.
I heard about that. I'm not sure. I mean, I've seen a lot of names and a lot of, like, I'm cutting down a bit on the names because it's just like, that's not really what's important about that stuff, but really where the ideas are coming from and how it influenced different generations, even though we don't know it. That's the thing. It influenced the society we're in, even though it's nowhere to be seen. Or so. So, okay. That was Ascona, Monte Verita, the hanging spot for the oligarchs in the summer, you know, camp for how to create, like, the first hippies, and free love, and air bath, and all that. No. We're good.
Wow.
We gotta see, you know, these guys were influenced, and they influenced other people. So you had a movement in art, which completely, like, was coming out of there. You had what was called the Cabaret Voltaire in Switzerland, in Zurich, Switzerland. But you had people congregating there also after, like, they had their air bath trip and all that. They said, well, that's still 1895, like, you know, we're going to do something else. It's time for change. And so they were going there. But really, there was no big change because Von Laban was invited. They were dancing. They were doing different stuff in the back store of the Cabaret Voltaire. And so, but they influenced more people. Now they had poets who were coming in and actually going out, not just congregating there and just having a fiesta, but really like going and influencing all the culture in Europe. So you had this guy, Hugo Ball, who was with Emmy Hennings, who was in charge. He had taken the Cabaret Voltaire, and he said, well, look, you know, made a deal with the owner of the place. He said, well, you have good sausages, you have good beer, you have good meals, so we're going to actually bring people in your place. We're going to jack up your revenue. And we're going to have, you know, just say nothing. We're going to take your back store, and we're going to have intellectual discussion things. So these guys, well, you had von Laban and you had Jung. They're going there and discussing, you know, philosophy and dreams, different things. And so, from there, well, the Dada movement was created. And so that was the new artistic trend. So the Dada, you have Marcel Duchamp, one of the leaders in France, with André Breton. So Marcel Duchamp said, and it's pretty explicit, I mean. He says, when I discovered ready-made, which is this, I thought to discourage aesthetics. In Neo-Dada, they have taken my ready-made and found aesthetic beauty in them. I threw the bottle rack and the urinal into their faces as a challenge, and now they admire them for their aesthetic beauty. So the guy was just like, man, that's discouraging. Like, I want to destroy, you know, any kind of sense of beauty and any kind of... I wanted just to get rid of any of these fantasies people have, you know, about beauty, about evil, about... Just a new art, an anti-art. He wanted to get rid of art. Just completely. So, that's one of his piece of art. Which, you know, there was an intention, just, we're going to destroy civilization as people have known it. Just going to do extreme things. Create new situations. Create new frame for whatever, for art, for dance, or... Yeah?
Just out of curiosity, did anyone place a bid on it?
It's probably sold for millions of dollars.
Probably. It's art. But then you get... I have a better here. An explanation, because maybe if you didn't get, you know, what that is, you know, you're not aware of art, and, you know, didn't study. We have a better explanation here from these guys. Who wants to read it? Grégoire. That's the one.
Every product of disgust that is capable of becoming a negation of the family is Dada. Protest with the first of one's whole being is destructive action, Dada. Acquaintance with all the means detesto, rejected by the sexual prudishness of easy compromise and good manners, Dada. Abolition of logic, death of those who are incapable of creation, Dada. Every hierarchy and social equation established for values by our valid Dada. Every object, all objects, feelings, and obscurities, every apparition in the precise shock of parallel line are meant for the battle of Dada. The abolition of hierarchy, Dada. The abolition of prophets, Dada. The abolition of future, Dada. The absolute and indisputable belief in every god that is an immediate product of spontaneity, Dada. Dada, Dada, Dada. The war of contorted pains and interweaving of contraries and of all contradictions, tricks, and irrelevancies of life.
Good mission statement.
Any questions? That was clear. Alright. I thought it was very clear.
I think it's summed up in the abolition of the future.
Yeah.
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, but you see, it's recurrent. Like, all these guys, whether it's in Monte Verita, whether it's wherever they assemble, it's always like, you know, logic, reason, like, discovery, principles.
There's a vehemence against it.
Yeah.
It's not just an indifference to it, it's an actual hatred.
But what do they achieve? Like, what is their ideology of, you know, principles? Like, what do they see in their mind? Do they see, like, evil? Do they see destruction?
Go back one slide.
Well, it's beyond. like we were mentioning, like Nietzsche at some point, like with this guy Bernard Shaw, like, you know, you have different factions, but really it goes to saying, well, it's beyond good and evil. It's beyond, like, there's no good and evil. Like, you can't just do whatever you want. So,
well, it's the feeling, and it's the feeling like that, that to define something is to define good, for instance, or to define evil. There's a hatred of that because it's this perception that it's a restriction of freedom.
Yeah. Well, think of the Aleister Crowley quote that you had up
there.
That's it. That's really, yeah,
that sums it up.
Thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
Yeah. Of course, that is also, it should be noted, the, well, maybe you'll get into.
I don't know, maybe, but...
essential tenet of statism.
Yeah, you're right. No, that's okay. I was not necessarily going to go through that, but yeah, that's exactly what Aleister Crowley... Even though they're going to create, like, new words for it, they're going to say, no, it's more pan-telema, or bringing different names into the equation to just confuse people, but yeah, that's basically what it is.
Could the manifestation of this, like, in people today come in the form of, when you're speaking to someone and they're fighting vehemently for this point that nothing can be known?
Mm.
You meet people and they're just like, you can't, the human mind is incapable of comprehending something as sophisticated as the universe. You get a lot of people that argue in that way. I mean, it sounds like that's sort of an extension of this.
All right, we have two. All right.
look in modern philosophy, like the authors who are praised are not Plato. It's not like Socrates. It's Heidegger. Kant is like none of it really.
Kant is. We're gonna get through that a lot more. Don't worry.
Kant refocus. Postgraduate studies, it's Kant. That's it. There's nothing else.
Well, there isn't.
You don't
hear it.
You can't do
anything.
It's over.
You can't do anything else.
Nailed the code.
All right, but these guys, the data guys, they got a bit bored after a certain time. Like you said, man, that's not enough. We're going to do more, like, of the same. But we're going to change our name. So they called it Surrealism. Over reason. So, they made it clear, that's what we stand for. So they wanted to destroy everything, even time. So they said, well, the simplest surrealist act consists of dashing down into the street, pistol in hand, and firing blindly, as fast as you can, pull the trigger into the crowd. That's from the second Surrealist Manifesto. Like the most. So these guys, they were the same. Like there was André Breton, Salvador Dali, Jean Cocteau, Louis Argand. They were all coming from the data, or they were like adding up onto like the former structure of the data, which is changed name because it didn't want to be data. I would say it's probably like these guys, like André Breton, like because that's the manifesto. So there's no name, I think, on it. I could try to find the original one, maybe. Yeah, maybe. But that's called the manifesto.
I'm just curious, like, did you look into that particular, like, why they thought that represents
realism? It's hard. I don't know. I think it's hard to actually define because it's really like it's unprincipled. Like what they want to do is really just tear apart like society, like what they said in the data before. Just like they're just throwing things at you just to actually shock you, and then people would, yeah, a lot of people were shocked. But at a certain time, like the effect is, huh? They were
shocked.
they might have been shocked.
Okay.
I don't know if they ever actually put in practice what they said. But, I mean, these guys were all coming from these circles of the Cabaret Voltaire, like these Jungian kind of cycle analysis. What the Surrealist movement was also doing. I'm
like,
Yeah,
just the destruction of this idea of this self-consciousness, of self-reflexiveness, where you get the sense of remorse,
pity
or whatever. So it's like you're saying, well, this is the ultimate act of separation from that. You can actually go blind and kill anyone.
It's like the effect of Grand Theft Auto on kids.
Yeah.
The description. Your average gameplay. Mm-hmm. What happens to the kid's mind?
Yeah, there's no limit. The morality being a big limit to get that out of the way.
Yeah.
Well, exactly.
It reminds me of the image that, for me, that disgusting image comes up is the William S. Burroughs incident.
Oh, yeah.
He was a writer. This is a direct link to his action of blowing his wife's head off. Because he used to play the William Tell game at parties. William Tell, this mythologist, it's this myth about him firing arrows and splitting an apple on top of his wife's head, right?
It's his son's head.
It's William Burroughs brings this forward and uses a pistol, a gun, to blow an apple off the head of his wife. And one day he shoots it between the eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was he doing that like as a matter of creating art?
It was his party trick.
Party trick?
Yeah, at a big party.
Oh,
okay. At one point, his wife would line up against a tree with an apple on her head, and he would blow the apple up her head. One day he put a bullet in her mouth. This is like, and it was weird for me, like growing up and reading these things, and sort of, you know, like, wow, this is strange, you know, like here in Loathing in Las Vegas and all of these the strange books, and, you know, what's going on here? I mean, what is art, you know? And then that's the morality of the people writing this.
Is the
fact that he would actually line his wife up and blow an apple off of her head because he actually truly is misogynist. Morally, totally decrepit.
What these guys were doing, like the Surrealists also, what they did, at some point you had one guy, what's his name? I'm not sure if I have the name. But they founded the Surrealist International, and that's when actually Mary Wigman came into play in the Surrealist. She was a former Laban dancer from Monte Verita. So you
who's that?
All the roads lead from Laban to from Monte Verita to Surrealism. Mary Wigman, she was a dancer. She was one of these happy fellows on the mountain, holding hands. So she came in, and what happened at the time is that I haven't written down the name, but that's not that important. But one of the Surrealists was working in an asylum, and they decided one day, hey, these guys in the asylum, they can paint. And so he gave them sheets of paper and, you know, brushes, or I don't know what they used, but, and, you know, paint something. And then he took it, he said, all right, that's what we gotta do. He said, that's art. And they created like a book, all of mentally ill paintings. They said, that's going to be the example. That's what we need. and they were like, you know, they were giving like all kinds of, it looked like, you know, like something done by Mentally Ill. So it was naturally like hard to find anything, like any idea in it, but he had some shapes, he had some colors, he had, so they said, well, that's probably like our dream. It's probably like, that's like our unconsciousness. And so they were deriving, you know, tons of stuff from just like a piece of paper painted by Mentally Ill. And they said, that's going to be our example. That's what we have to reproduce, imitate. That's
like
surreal.
Sometimes done with,
huh?
With abstract art, where you actually do get the monkey to paint the thing.
Yeah.
And you put it on the wall and listen to the conversations about people interpreting.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like
so, just so, what year is that?
That's like 1920s. Because you have the data, the well, 1930s, 20s, 30s, you have the data and then the surrealism. Then you have also this automatism.
Yeah.
So just like, you had this surrealism split it again. Like they like to split and reform and whatever. But then you had the Copenhagen, Berlin, and that's like the acronym, like was named the Cobra. And they said, well, the dissolution of Western classical culture is a phenomenon that can be understood only against the background of a social evolution, which can end only in the total collapse of society thousands of years old, and its replacement by a system whose laws are based on the immediate demands of human vitality. So, you know, they just make it clearer every time. Just like, you know, that's what we're here for. We're here to actually destroy any kind of reference you have to art. Everything like that came in the last 2,000 years, it's finished. Like, we're going to stop that. And that was still like these guys from the surrealist movement were changing names and coming back together and stating these kinds of weird stuff.
Is this the idea that people change their personality? The popularity of like just making up their names? I know some professors.
Not sure.
Like, my friends gave me the name John, but I want to be called Jack. You know?
They might have had these kinds. I'm not sure.
He was
I think it was really... the Cobra, we know where it comes from.
Oh, okay.
So the name of the cities. But it's just like they want to change stuff, but the thing they is that it's always the same people. They want to change stuff, why don't they change the people? You know, it's kind of funny paradox, you know. All these guys are actually doing the same thing over and over again, but changing the way they approach it. Now, in the Cobra, what they were doing is that they were like, society is oppressive. The way buildings are shaped, that's oppressive. We got to change architecture overall. We got to create the new Babylon. That's what we need. So they had this goal now of actually creating a new Babylon, where, well, I mean, they had many designs, but it was just, I mean, it was, yeah, everything, like, architecture is oppressive, like the way
city?
Society, huh?
Sorry, what city? Oh, never mind, city.
Yeah, it's somewhere in my notes here, I'm not too sure. It's Copenhagen, and I didn't find it quick.
It's
Copenhagen, Brussels, and Amsterdam. Exactly. Yeah, a lot of stuff came from Amsterdam. Where am I? Okay, that's... I want to show you that also, because that's like the most extreme one. But that's the art which was, or the movement which was created to bring about fascism. That was a futurism kind of movement. That was you could have just called it fascism, the same thing. They said, we intend to sing the love of danger, the habit of energy and fearlessness. Except in struggle, there is no more beauty. No work without an aggressive character can be a masterpiece. Poetry must be conceived as a violent attack on unknown forces to reduce and prostrate them before men. We stand on the last promontories of the centuries. Why should we look back when what we want is to break down the mysterious doors of the impossible? Time and space died yesterday. We already live in the absolute because we have created eternal, omnipresent speed. We will glorify war, the world's only hygiene. Militarism, patriotism, destructive gesture of freedom bringers, beautiful ideas worth dying for, and scorn for women. We will destroy the museums, libraries, academies, and every kind will fight moralism, feminism, every opportunistic or utilitarian cowardice. I think you're ready.
Go, Stuart, Stuart!
I mean, we gotta also think about, like, it doesn't mean that our grandparents were all futurists, but the thing is, you know, like, the society in which they were living in was influenced by these kind of ideas, which were mostly brought, like, in Europe first, and then transmitted in the United States, in America, in different forms. But if people want to check it out, but I have the name of the guy who actually founded futurism was a good friend of Mussolini. Actually got arrested with him a couple of times, but before became dictator and all that.
Sparta,
well, that's the same mentality, yeah. It's exactly like, you know, militaristic society. And, well, you know, might is right.
You can see where peacekeeping is formed under this type of idea. You know, destructive gesture of freedom bringers. You know,
well, what is their view of freedom? Right? I mean,
yeah. But the most important thing, I think, is really, like, what we've seen, like, when I was talking about this guy, when Jung talks about the purge, when they talk about the world's only hygiene being war, like, these guys, like, they want to create a society, but for that, they have to actually wage a war against civilization. Actually, they have to destroy what created civilization. You know, that's really what they're attacking. They're saying, like, that's what we have to do. We have to be clean, because in, you know, thousands of years ago, we didn't have this, we didn't have that, we didn't have... So they're really, like, trying to go back, like, thousands of years. And thousands of years
this
ago.
Primordial state when we didn't have any of these artificial social conventions imposed upon us, right? That are
like enough.
You want to unleash the beast. That's what they're really talking about.
Like electricity and enough food.
Yeah, right. That kind of thing.
So obviously we know what came from that. But, that was the Lavan dancer there. But actually, these rallies in Nuremberg, because Lavan was in Monte Verita. But he became the choreographer for Hitler's troops. Yeah. He had Oh yeah, Wagner. Just to illustrate what kind of music they were dancing to. And Nietzsche. But really, like, these rallies were like experiments of how you could actually direct courses of thousands of people, or, you know, hundreds of singers also, choruses, and military deployment of people. And that was all choreographed by the Laban School of Dance in Zurich, and in it was brought in Germany and all that. He was at a certain point expelled because Goebbels didn't like him. But you know, he'd done his he already had brought that kind of opulence and way of making these rallies and the music and all. It was all you remember the Svastika where we saw it before. It was all this kind of mystical thing behind, like, you know, it like we would be missing if we don't talk about the way the British actually orchestrated it. But really, it was a creation in the culture that, like, they wanted to reverse the Judeo-Christian, the Jewish Renaissance in Germany, and bring back mythology into being the way people will orient their actions, and to just suppress the individuality also, as Lamari was saying, like this act of actually destroying self-consciousness and just going with the flow. And that's what these choreography were made for, just to create an environment where people have their assigned place, and that's how you move, and that's where you go, and that's how the music goes also. So that's what we got. Now, getting to the after war. I got a video for you, actually. No, I'm not sure. One sec. Ah. So you had the war. I mean, I'm going over a lot of things. But you had the war, and then... Well, then we had to fight communism. This is propaganda.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it. If a person consistently reads and advocates the views expressed in a communist publication, he may be a communist. If a person supports organizations which reflect communist teachings, or organizations labeled communist by the Department of Justice, she may be a communist. If a person defends the activities of communist nations while consistently attacking the domestic and foreign policy of the United States, she may be a communist. If a person does all these things over a period of time, he must be a communist. But there are other communists who don't show their real faces, who work more silently.
By the early 1950s, Communist Party membership had declined considerably, but Cold War propaganda inflated its threat to fantastic proportions. An evil so pervasive that the whole society had to be mobilized to combat it.
May Day brings a wave of anti-communist sentiment as 100,000 march down New York's Fifth Avenue in a loyalty parade. Everyone from vets to youngsters reveals his inborn dislike of communism. And you send an answer to those threatening our country's liberty.
Volunteer for foreign work.
Linda, why?
Because try to convince me that I should free myself of the lingering bourgeois influence of family life. I'm ready. Do not interfere. It is for my own good.
Comrade, do not think that your deviationist remarks shall be overlooked. It will be reported to the proper authorities.
Those are the communists?
Right.
I'm sure you could probably find the whole thing. I didn't want to play, you know.
I just wanted to.
Just wanted to show, you know, because you have these different movements were like kind of put on the back in the background during the war, but really like still these guys were all controlled, you know. Where think about that, you know, where the money was coming from, this new art, and you know, what, how were they able to develop wide, you know, because nobody would buy that, these pieces of crap, like, you know, the urinary.
It's government funded.
Well, maybe some government, yeah, especially after the Second World War, because now you were into the Cold War, now you have to defeat communism. And now, you know, the CIA, you know, that was a fight in between the different agencies who would preserve freedom, right? Or the expansion of communism, or, you know, this or that. So you had big wars, but really before, like, before it was taken as really, like, a serious thing, it was all funded from these oligarchical families in Europe, and probably in the United States, to bring about that kind of world state that H.G. Wells, and also like the way Bertrand Russell was looking at mass psychology. So I mean, there was a big traumatism after the Second World War, because Roosevelt died, and now all the policies that Roosevelt wanted to implement were just thrown in the garbage by people like Truman, and especially Churchill was taking over the U.S. policy, the U.S. politics, and by using Truman, and then you had McCarthy, the Pepsi guy, I think. Anyway, he was doing publicity for advertising for soda drink. And then he became the, you know, the man who would save America from communism. And, so that was a shock for the population, which, you know, would bring about a kind of a new culture in the United States. So I'm going to look a bit about the United States, Europe and the United States, and looking at what was brought after the war, actually continue the same kind of work that these little movements had done before the war, was now brought, you know, very publicly. It was really, they wanted to change everything and real fast. So really, like, they wanted to bring, I said liberalism, political correctness. They wanted to change the mindset, like, continue, like, this idea that there's no truth. There's just no way you can figure it out. We got to destroy reason and anything that stands in the way of our freedom. That's what they said, anyway. So, yeah, different things which were created. The ISR, Institute on Social Research, the Frankfurt School, and the CCF. So I got some juicy quotes from these guys. Val, do you want to read that one?
Sure.
Or take some more?
Okay, Theodore Adorno. It is not that schizophrenia is directly expressed therein, but the music imprints upon itself an attitude similar to that of the mentally ill. The individual brings about his own disintegration. He imagines the fulfillment of the promise through magic. But nonetheless, within the realm of immediate actuality, its concern is to dominate schizophrenic traits through the aesthetic consciousness. In so doing, it would hope to vindicate insanity as true health. In the philosophy of modern music.
Yeah, so Adorno was part of these crew, this crew which was involved into like trying to crush totalitarianism, I guess you'd say. So it was basically, the big thing was that anybody who was saying he knew what was right was an authoritarian personality. He was outright fascist. We couldn't tolerate that in society. That was Hitler. That was the, you know, the prototype. And look at what happened in World War II. So it couldn't be accepted. Theodore Adorno was more on the musical side of it, but he contributed a lot on these studies, which created, which altogether was put into a book called The Authoritarian Personality. And so he said, well, you know, modern music is basically like, you know, how to create schizophrenia in people. But that's going to be like the normal state of human beings in society. That's actually health. So these guys, it's weird. And there was a big crowd, I mean. But that the melon just left. What? Look, you can't judge, okay? But really, you can't say if anything is good. So Walter Benjamin, this guy, he was part of this group of people who were studying Kant with Theodore Adorno and creating these groups of intellectual financing, you know, the people around the existentialist movement in Europe and everywhere else. Ah, Melvin, you're back. Good. I didn't want to go away. I didn't want to skip this one until you come back. So you've seen the one with Theodore Adorno, the authoritarian personality. This one, you've seen that one, yeah?
I was just like that.
Okay, yeah, these guys were a bunch of people working to save humanity from communism and authoritarian personality. And this guy Walter Benjamin is pretty interesting. Because he says, like, he's, you know, we're just going through the same thing, but he's elaborating more and more on what is wrong with civilization. What he says is wrong with our civilization. He says clearly, it's wrong to start with the reasonable, hypothesizing mind as the basis of the development of civilization. This is an unfortunate legacy of Socrates. It's pretty clear, huh? I don't know what you think about it. Some people will think it's funny. You're not laughing at me, right? Okay.
The basis of reason is just a bad way to think about or starting point of civilization. Or it's incompatible with society.
Like, there's no pattern. Like, it's just like, it's arbitrary.
Why is it wrong? I mean, like, what happens? Do you know anything about how he developed this idea? Why is it wrong to begin with that?
Well, Yeah, well, there's this other quote, which he goes, well, these guys were basically, they were trying to change the culture. Like that, they were just like, it's like, you know, psychological warfare that they're waging against their own population. And they think that they're going to save them from communism in doing that. But really, there's another quote I didn't put where they're saying, well, communism is attacking us with irrationality. So the way we can actually defeat that is to go even more irrational. Like, we got to lie, even, like, have bigger lies. And that's why they take, actually, they take back Plato. And they say, well, the big lie, and you see that in political science with Leo Strauss and all these things, like, it goes around in all the different sectors. And they just basically say, you know, there's no truth, and the biggest lie will win. So we just gotta make people confused, in a sense, on what they have to believe in. So there are more, there's a good article you can read if you want to know more about the guy. But he was, just to know, he was part of that circle with Adorno, Arendt. All these guys were working together.
That's right there.
Yeah, that's it.
He looks a bit like me.
yeah.
You can think about how that idea is applied in the West. I know Bruce has brought this up sometime in his presentation, that there is a certain assumption about ancient history that man arose, well, the default state of man over humankind is superstition, paganism,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. That's really what's taught. You know, you go, they'll take these tribes, these indigenous tribes, these backwards the Dark Age cultures, and say that's the natural state of man. Everything after that is just artificially imposed. But the true nature of man is this. Right? That's our. But, well, I mean, that's a massive assertion.
And also, I can bring something more, because this guy Walter Benjamin, he was a bit more sophisticated than, well, we could say, more pompous maybe, than the other people like Adorno and Arendt. He would actually go back in the Bible and say, and interpret the Genesis passage of the Garden of Eden. He was talking about, you know, when God created the universe. It was like, you know, the created the Word, like the Word was, and then, well, he took it literally. He just said, like, it's not about reason. It's not about logos. It's about the word. So it's in the word that the meaning lies. So it was just like, he said, you know, he was quoting the Vulgate translation of the Bible. He was saying, like, that's what it is. You know, that's in the Bible. There's no rationality in the Bible. There's nothing that you can actually understand as being true. It's all just in the word. So everything depends on what word you use or how you use them. And so the idea of the, you know, if you don't take into account the older philosophical, the logos, the term logos, and what it means, you're missing everything. So, but that's how he was actually defending, how civilization had grown since then. He said, like, oh, you know, that's what we said. That's it. It's just it. They knew it from the beginning. Nothing's rational. It's all just in the word. So, I mean, that's
meanwhile,
big
like
perversion.
Your second cup of coffee. You know what I mean? Like, the the irony is huge, because while they're talking about this, you're like wearing your latest style, you're sitting in a comfortable place, having your next cup of coffee,
benefiting,
taking
from
a break for a meal, you know, like nothing is rational, and yet somehow we magically survive, and dinner keeps coming. Nothing is rational.
Well, that's how big it
So what?
Very good. Okay. There's also George Lucas. There you go.
George.
Huh?
George. Different from George Lucas.
No, not Lucas, but Lucas. Yeah.
Lucas.
He was working with Herbert Marcuse. And it makes it clear. I mean, just another quote. It's not it's such a big deal. But you were talking about Heidegger, not one. Like Anna Arendt. It's pretty much. She brought in Benjamin. Like, she was the first one to translate Benjamin in English and bring it to the United States, and with existentialism also.
Conflict resolution and power, like in terms of power, she sounds a bit like a Trump. Beware, she's actually like a Trump.
But she was bringing really what these guys were developing in Europe. She brought it in America when she fled, because she couldn't be a member of the Nazi Party since she was Jewish.
For her power is, well, that's a quote from her. I'm not sure.
That's not a quote.
I mean, there's a quote from her
that
says that she believes that power is not in the individual, but it's a collective contract.
Well, she also said the United States were not a nation state. She was big on that too. She's like, you know, nation states, that's like in Europe. But the United States is just like a melting pot of, you know, lots of things. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work.
So she was very coming from very much the racial idea.
Mm-hmm.
She was thinking of nations in terms of racially defined force.
Kind of stuff, yeah.
Do you think she brought it into the United States with love?
I don't know. As in Agape? No.
Where's the love, Hannah? Where's the love?
George Lukacs? He was a communist. Then he changed. He worked with the OSS and the CIA afterward to actually defeat communism. And then he founded the Green Party in Germany. Wow.
Yeah.
So these guys are involved everywhere. You had the Tavistock Institute, you know, I'm just naming them like quickly right now. Just a funny story I found out yesterday, because we were talking about Jean-Paul Sartre. And, well, you had the Merlin Group. The Merlin Group here.
Merlin, like
the
wizard?
Like the wizard, yeah. It was constituted of people like Christopher Logg, John Coleman, Baird Bryant, John Stevenson, George Clinton. And these guys were all followers of Samuel Beckett. Does anybody know Samuel Beckett? You know him? Yeah, that's right. The theater of the absurd. Like, that was after war, you know, pessimism, which was translated into plays. And but Samuel Beckett became famous after he got psychoanalyzed at the Tavistock Institute. He got taught Jung, Carl Jung. And also, the Merlin Group were followers of him, and they are the first one that actually published Jean-Paul Sartre and Jean Genet. Because he couldn't be published anywhere else. They actually decided, oh, we're going to publish you? No problem. So they actually put him on the map. That's where... That's, you know, one thing. I just thought it was so funny yesterday when we discussed that. It was, anyway. the CCS. Again, to destroy communism and free people. And you have Bertrand Russell, the chairman of it. So that's, you know, this is on the cultural side, but we've got to look at also what's going on at the same time in terms of the politics. And you really have a creation of a nightmare for the baby boomer to actually destroy them and just bring about a real big shift. Like all these things that were discussed prior, like in the at Monte Verita and all that, like all the drugs that was taken there, now they wanted to make it everywhere. They wanted to make it public. They wanted to just, because before it was used by the elite, only the elite were able to experience, you know, the so-called truth by, you know, drug and mysticism and psychedelic trips. So now they wanted to make it public, and they wanted to create a fear even bigger than what had existed before. So the nuclear fear and assassination, one after the other, just to ram it through people that, you know, you can't really change anything. Change is not a principle of the universe. It just will never change. You can try to be good, but that's not necessarily going to work. And they were destroying the leadership of the 1960s. They're trying to actually bring back the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt and tell the United States, well, go back to the principle of the United States. And so you had different attacks on it. And that's where, you know, these guys like Aldous Huxley are coming in. Because they've been working since 1931 and even before, like when you know the history of their family. They've been working to creating that conception that people are just like balls of emotion. You can control them by changing their emotion. And if you have drugs, well, that's even better. And he was searching for a type of drug that would create schizophrenia in people, in the population. Create like an order. Ordering the disorder, right? That's what he wanted to do. And since 1931, he was searching for LSD, in a sense, which was discovered afterwards. But that's what he was searching for. Since 1931, when he had written Brave New World, and that's also Brave New World, like Bertrand Aldous Huxley and Bertrand Russell were kind of on the same side, and then in 1931, the faction which was more aligned with H.G. Wells, they were like, no, it's not about drugs, it's about reducing population. So what Huxley was trying to bring about is a dystopia, not a utopia, but a dystopia, where actually you have a kind of a benevolent dictator. He's still a dictator, but he's benevolent. Like we're going to tell people if they can have children or not. We're going to regulate that. But everybody's going to be so happy because they'll be on drugs. So we're going to have a higher caste. It's coming back at the, you know, where this idea of the caste system from India, from all the studies that the British Empire had done on how to control their colonies. That's where it comes in again. Matt, what?
I'm just trying to see the connection here because I read something about the Tavistock Institute.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you have heard of it, but the distinction between the empirical rational school of thought and the re-educated school of thought, which dealt more with like emotion, like a separation between rational thinking and emotion, and situational ethics. Like situational ethics, that means whenever you have a group of people, and in terms of like supposed good leadership, you are able to tap in on the rational, empirical, side of people or the immortal side to bring out the desired outcome. So I see that a lot, that connection with even
the Congress together.
It's reinterpreted.
Yeah, it actually is. Yeah, but that's not science and that's not art. It's not statecraft overall. It's just how the oligarchy wants to. It's how they want to use you. But that's where we have to actually look at what's their intention and how we can overcome that. So that's, we're almost there. But there's this quote by Huxley, who was, you know, addressing the Tavistock group in California, 1961. And so he says, there will be, in the next generation or so, a pharmacological method of making people love their servitude and producing dictatorship without tears, so to speak. Producing a kind of painless concentration camp for entire societies, so that people will in fact have their liberties taken away from them, but will rather enjoy it, because they will be distracted from any desire to rebel by propaganda or brainwashing enhanced by pharmacological methods. This seems to be the final revolution. Yeah. Hardcore stuff.
That's my opinion.
Well, it's nice that you're considerate enough to the people that you want to not cause them pain.
It's a benevolent dictatorship.
That is generous.
So. And then,
Julian Crump.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you had riots and all that, and I'm passing over a lot of stuff, but if you want to go back, take some quotes.
We actually have these talks that he gave in... It's called The Ultimate Revolution, and he's talking to a bunch of students, and they're just eating it up.
Yeah.
They're just loving it. Mm-hmm. Asking them questions.
Oh, weird.
So, what do you think, think it's really going to happen?
He had given them Soma before.
He also writes a book in the 40s, I think, or like 46, called Brave New World Revisited.
Yeah.
And you really got to take the two of them together. Because Brave New World, he puts out his hypothesis as a story, but in Brave New World Revisited, he's commenting upon things. Chapter 1 is overpopulation, and that this is the biggest threat to humanity.
Exactly.
But he goes through everything systematically, like the drug, the utilization of drugs, the scientific dictatorship, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, it's all right there, you know, much more theoretical. But you got to take the two together.
Yeah, it's especially you see the trend, the idea of eugenics.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually, you have different classes of people. And then you have better people that you're going to engineer. And you have the servants who are also engineered to be stupid but to like their work.
Yeah. You only
and you give them drugs whenever they are confused about what's the meaning of life and whatever they have to do.
Soma?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's also a god.
Yeah.
That's in the... Is it it's an Indian
god?
Well,
the Indian version of Dionysus, really.
So, these guys, you know, the Beatles were not, you know, revolutionary when they went in India. They were late in about 50 years. But that's really where it comes from. That's where these ideas come from. And, you know, even the Golden knew, he knew to a certain extent what was going on. He knew that these things in France were not created in France. He knew that these things, they could not have been coming out of civilization just like that. And so in May 1968, which people are just like praising right now, So the anniversary, you know, 50 years, 40 years, and, you know, it's so great. But really, like, these things were organized by these groups. The former Dada, the former Surrealist, the former, you know, all these guys who'd been in contact with the Monte Verita before, and we're now teaching in universities that work was oppression, that everything
so
has to change.
May 1968 was the great group.
The uprising, yeah.
In France, right?
In France, in the Netherlands, in everywhere. You had all these groups who had been created to actually take down society. And so you had massive riots, especially in France. I mean, you had big riots and occupation of schools, and it was pretty big. But De Gaulle said when he came back, and he was, you know, he had to come back with the army. He came back in Paris, and he made a speech, he said, well, begins the speech, and then, this explosion was provoked by a few groups in revolt against modern society, against consumer society, against technological society, whether communist in the East or capitalist in the West. Groups, moreover, which do not know what they would put in its place, but which delight in negation. That was really the intention, which was communicated in the population of the baby boomer. And, you know, nothing has really changed right now. I mean, they've been trying to take that down, but really, we have to make sure that truth prevails, and that actually we're going to go back, because obviously science has been destroyed to, you know, big extent. Culture, I mean, art, the meaning of it has been lost somehow, you know, like right now in schools that you're not really going to try to understand the universe and represent it for other people to actually understand it too. Make discoveries about the universe and transmit them. But that's what we have to actually make sure. And as Lynn was saying in the first quote, that's the work that our youth movement is in, is challenging all these institutions to actually go back and figure out the universe, study Kepler, study science, music, and all these things from the standpoint that you can actually know these things. You can actually figure it out. And so I didn't want to, you know, depress people today. So I wanted to finish that and, you know, go into discussion. And I purposefully didn't talk about rock music or anything of that sort. Because I didn't think it was really necessary.
It's going to be more of the same.
Yeah. Because, yeah. And we can discuss, you know, things that people want to bring up and all that, things they would have put in a presentation like that. But I wanted to end with a quote by Schiller, which is, you know, an inspiration for today, actually. So, Matthew?
For only can a great and noble cause arouse humanity's profoundest nature. In smaller spheres, the mind of man contracts, but with a nobler purpose, grows the greater. And as the century is gravely ending, and even what is real to fable turns, when we behold huge forces locked in battle, and our portentous goal is hovering near. And war is waged for man's most noble causes, for domination and for liberty. So now, let art attempt to soar yet higher upon the shadow stage, indeed she must, lest she be put to shame by life's own drama.
So that's after the American Revolution. And I think it's a good advice. Let's keep on fighting. it.
Certainly
any questions?
Certainly the difference after 68. It's not just the phenomenon of the counterculture itself, but that for the first time, I suppose, in all of European history, world history, the counterculture became the culture. No longer the counterculture, it was the culture. And I don't know if that has ever happened before. I suppose like under the Roman Empire. Even in the 20s, I mean, you might have had a lot of decadence in different areas, but...
Yeah.
I mean, these were still...
But still, these guys, like the Dada movement and all these things were still small. Like they were...
They're running around and...
Yeah.
Pulling them.
They were trying to destroy things, but really, it's just after the Second World War, actually, really, that's where, with the process of denazification in Germany, like with the Frankfurt School and Adorno and all these guys, they were actually getting rid of people like Kurt Wangler, you know, the conductor, and replacing him with a former Nazi party member, von Karajan. And they were, you know, it was pretty explicit. These guys were, making it clear that they were taking over at the time. And, well, was that all? I thought, rather, I didn't want to cut him into the... Just... Sorry.
I've never heard about this Monte Verita stuff before. Where did you...
Well, it's we have a member, not a member, but a good contact in Los Angeles. Actually, he did that little booklet of different things he dug up and things which were not necessarily in the EIR and the different studies on the oligarchy and the counterculture, the Dark Age culture that we had, you know, put together. And he had that insight because he comes from the punk culture in the 1980s, and 1980s, he was it's Hobbs. What's his name? In California, and he gave a seminar in Leesburg 2 years ago. And
talk about the guy who worked with Michelle Bernard.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, name? I don't know.
It's Hobbs. I don't remember the old name. I talked to him and it was very fun because he was in these circles, like the punk rock circles in the 1980s.
Right.
Just going around and, you know, at a certain point he got older.
He
met us and the first thing he saw was the Schiller book. It's like, wow, I gotta know about this. He knew a bit from different, you know, old stuff that they were bringing up, like Adorno and all these guys were talking about Schiller, but they were saying like, oh, what Schiller really wanted to say is that, you gotta bring out the Eros, like that's what, you know, really like freedom is. You wanted to free people, but like to get the erotic pulsions or whatever out. And complete perversion of what Schiller was saying. But so he knew the name. He saw the book. He's like, oh, I heard about that. And then he dug into it and he said, whoa, that's something you gotta investigate. Because all his friends, we were in the punk movement, right now are like Silicon Valley and MySpace and you know, computer games and all that. That's what they do. The punk rock culture became the internet space, the programmers.
Program your own society.
Yeah, and there's like a whole other, there's an old, I cut down my class, it was like impossible, just couldn't put it together. But there would be like two more classes on that, like after 60. 1960, and what happened? But anyway, I wanted to spare you from. Just wanted to do the story.
Later, though, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's going to take a lot of work, but yeah, I want to dig it up. Yeah, well, there's already the work from Holmes, but yeah, no, it's just really fun because, yeah, this thing, Monte Verita, yeah, I had no ideas. Yeah, there was something fishy that you see when you look at the culture, like, why are the doors, the beals, all these guys, you know, praising Aleister Crowley? What's up with that? Because Sergeant Pepper, the first words are referring to the anniversary of Aleister Crowley. Like, yeah, you can check it out. I mean, it's just funny that these things, they're just praising him, like, publicly. They're also saying, like, great, you know, the CIA helped, you know, the spreading of LSD, and we gotta really, like, thank the CIA for that. They're just like, whoa. So these guys, they knew what was going on. Like, they were pawned. Like, they were just, like, being used. But they had certain things they believed in, and that's why they were also continuing doing it. Otherwise, it would have just been erased from the map. But so, yeah, these things, I didn't want to go too much. Anyway, the mystical stuff is not intelligible, so don't want to spend too much time on that. It's just their own thing. You know. They're trying to make it like a big stuff. Like, really. I don't know. Any comments? Insults? No. Okay. Oh, great.
Well, do you think it's the same way that these people try to pervert Plato? Could be similar to the way that they bring Eastern culture into the situation.
Yeah.
You know, like, they'll use Plato or Schiller, let's say, to justify the way that they're thinking, the philosophical basis. Could they not then be doing the same thing to Eastern culture? Or do you think that there's something inherent in Eastern cultures which is counter to the development ideas that we have regarding the economy, regarding the development of the mind?
I think there's something very specific about the idea that man is defined by his ability to tap into creative reason, and he has a certain relationship with the universe that isn't exactly that you locate in Socrates and Judeo-Christian thought. That is not really, you can't find it. You can search for it, but you can't really find that in that same way. Like, man is defined as something in either Hindu mysticism, Buddhism. There's a sense that man is different from animals, but only in the sense that, you know, he can transcend, but there's no, like, that idea of creative reason is lacking fully from all the texts I've yet come across. So I think that yeah. I think there is certainly something lacking in it.
Because Buddhism originally is a non-theistic religion. It's based on seeking to know. But you're right, I mean, it's seeking to know through...
It's contemplation. Yeah, it's contemplation. Yeah, it's
through abstinence and through not doing. I mean, the monks are pretty active people in terms of building in their skills but yeah, it doesn't then move on to okay, well, how can we use these ideas we've discovered to increase our capacity for population?
Yeah, change the universe for the better.
Yeah, it's very much focused on not changing things.
Yeah.
On doing as little as possible.
Yeah, like once this the Winnipeg
the karmic idea that if you do something then you're now karmically responsible for what you've done.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, it's an interesting concept in terms of trying to be good and trying to do things that you don't actually have to pay back.
leave less of a footprint as possible.
Yeah.
Like, build these things, but only so you can remove yourself.
Well, there's a whole hierarchy of karma in terms of, like, eating something like that. That's why the vegetarians, and if you start eating animals, then you're actually, you're gaining a lot of karmic, a lot of karma, which you will have to pay off in this endless cycle of life, reincarnation. And it's the whole idea being to escape that and achieve the nirvana.
Yeah, I think one thing is really like the caste system. Because when Lin talks about that, he wrote a paper recently where he was discussing that the problem of the Eastern culture having this kind of oligarchical shape from a long time ago. He's talking especially, the Babylonian Persian Empire. But you still have that, like in India, you still have the really, like, it's there, the caste system.
Would the Confucian system, such as it exists in, say, South Korea, would that also be fall under the same kind of idea? The very strict hierarchy and family of social order?
I don't know. Yeah. I haven't done that much work on that, but that's something which, raises questions in my mind as to what is lacking or what, how. Because I don't think actually it was never there. I just think that there's something which prevented it from developing. Totally. And that's why also these oligarchs are so much against the United States, and the Declaration of Independence, which we read at the beginning. That all men are created equal. Like that's.
Whoa.
Not possible.
Yeah. Right.
Can't say that. But I think that's from that standpoint that you want to look at it. But also, like, right now it's interesting because you have the different countries like Russia, China, and India actually aligning themselves together at trying to develop, infrastructure and transportation and food supply. So it's not that you can't do anything with these guys. It's just that, there's certain things which have been missing here and there, and you got to try to bring the best that you have and go and search for the best that the other has and develop that mutually. I think that's the idea, how you want to actually create higher culture. Because remember in the quote of Lin, it says, like, it's not just about, like, continuing with what you have. Like, oh, yeah, you have gravitation. You're some gravitation. Kepler found that. But actually, like, okay, so you found it. So now we gotta bring it to a higher level. We gotta figure out more things to keep up civilization. And that involves also partaking that with other cultures. And, like poking on them and saying, hey, look, we figured that out. Maybe that changes something in the the way to conceive society. I think that
you mean by making a discovery, you can then say, hey, look what we did, this is the way we think, and what can you do?
Well, in the history, like,
in terms of being like to sort of light a fire under someone to get busy.
I
just
thought about this because thinking about the culture today. What is their culture? What are they under with today? And I just think about the fact that there one exists, but it's filtered through the counterculture, so their language, the way that they'll talk, is directed by that. For instance, movies and media, television, that sort of thing. So that defines a certain culture. But then I was thinking about, 50 years ago or 40 years ago, like how the culture would have been defined by the progressiveness of society. For instance, we had a space program, and even people who are involved in the space program see their existence of their nation as part of something which is actually pushing the entirety of civilization. As you think that you had with people who actually built up this nation to begin with, or who were, say if you were making a weapon in war, you were thinking about, you know, how is it that, you know, we're going to actually defeat the idea of the very disciplined empire. So you're thinking about making like a deadly weapon, or you're thinking about for the new general with the Russian of peace, ironically. You're saying, I want to advance technology, unlike, say, what the British are doing, in a stagnant society, right? Want to maintain a certain level of technology that already exists, but then prevent it in other nations from obtaining that. And so... Oh, but, you know, it's just interesting to think about, you know, like the how that affects the entire culture, like the identity of the individual, in terms of what they think they consist of their life to, you know, how the actual progressive development of society affects them. You know, it's very interesting to think about how, if you can imagine if we just didn't walk up on this continent. It is one project, so be it very grand, how it would completely transform every single person, not only on this continent, but in the world.
Mm-hmm.
To think about that level of integration of one continent through the development of water, these water projects, that could feed the entire world. Create that look, you know, yeah. Intensive irrigation capability. So, you know, it's just we're not in within that culture. We have to actually have a certain imagination to actually think of what that existence would do to transform society, rather than thinking about, because I live in a society which is stagnant, this is what society is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's really interesting to think about how necessary is that.
That, when you think about,
the future
in the past,
like how you
relate to it,
what, you know,
yeah, done. I think there's something fundamental in what you're saying in terms of this needed, like this very basic idea that you're talking about, in terms of thinking of your identity within the context of your nation as a force for driving for change, like this sort of greater understanding. Something that is almost completely absent from the classroom. Like, it's, I think the single greatest challenge for the educators today is the fact that, well, besides the fact that they have to change their own understanding, that's probably the secret. But then, in terms of actually having a class, the kid is just fighting against this massive or combo due to, I think, the separation in their understanding of what we're talking about, separation of self from society. There's nothing really of great inspiration going on right now. And that's the biggest hurdle, right? But the biggest thing after, but yeah, that very concept of actually being a potentially powerful creative force in society. And when you start, and the thing that kills it is when you bring in all of these ideas that, you know, that we were talking about today, it takes Plato and try and pervert it into something which is totally banal and useless. Then why would you want to learn Plato? Or you bring in all of these authors that are basically espousing these ideas that the universe can't change. Human beings are essentially animals. Reason was that, you know, kind of depressing word.
And then I'll just message you. I'll send problem. So I think I did not answer you.
Cancer, which is just boredom. Is that in the future? Or youth in the
classroom? Well, it's just bad. It's bad. That's how it is.
Artistic and creative.
How do you tell? It's just like a...
They know that.
Ah.
At least subconsciously.
Age off in it. Come on, that headline just come up.
Go on the what?
The what? record.
Right.